From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley.
Napa, California.
I live in the Castro Fillmore District.
Vernal Heights.
Oakland, California.
Coming up, young people's shifting attitudes towards family, marriage, and love.
If you're 30 or 25 or 30 or 35 and you live in a city, your parents should basically know that they're out of the matchmaking business. They are no longer responsible for hooking you up.
Also, we all know that clocks track the change in time, but what about the change in culture?
Yeah, some of the ladies' pieces back in the days were as small as this here. It's almost like a pea-sized watch.
And we can't stop time, but we can preserve moments in time, like local composer Christopher Hedge.
To me, sound is like a photograph. The moment that happens stays with that sound in this unique sort of way.
There's no moment like right now to stay tuned to Cross Currents. Next time you're out and about in San Francisco, take a look around. What's missing? You may come up with a number of answers to this question, but in this game of I Spy, we're asking you to find something little, squirmy, and loud. Babies! If you see one around, count yourself lucky because they're becoming an increasingly rare sight in the city. According to the 2010 census, San Francisco's population grew by 4% over the past 10 years, but its child population dropped by 5%. Now, there are many theories as to why this kid exodus has taken place. For one, it's really expensive to raise them here. But it also might have to do with the fact that more and more young people are delaying marriage and putting off having kids even longer. Well, there's no shortage of 20 and 30-somethings in San Francisco, especially in Dolores Park. That's where we sent KALW's John Atkinson to see if this trend rings true.
My name is Benjamin Dreyer. I'm 25.
My name is Alyssa. I'm 20 years old.
My name is Tommy. I'm 27.
My name is Monique. I think that marriage should be something beautiful and available to every single human being, man, woman, gay, straight, bi, gender, queer, gender bender.
Well, right now my parents are going through a divorce, actually, so I've been thinking about marriage a lot, and I think it might be a little bit outdated.
Me and all my friends, our parents are all still together. I think marriage as an institution is good if you want tax rebates and you want to get money back on having a bunch of kids, but as a necessity to me and a partner, there is no necessity for marriage.
I think that if somebody actually loves, if there's two people who actually love each other, you don't need to put a label on it.
People want to do it. I think it's awesome. You know, it's a choice that people can make. But I don't think that it should be necessary in our society for people to have to get married or, you know, to be an expectation put on people.
I think that love is this very spiritual bond and that it doesn't need to be confirmed by any type of ceremony.
It's really not about getting married. It's about finding a partner to share the rest of my life with and to enjoy and have fun and share the rest of experiences of growing old together.
I don't think that I'm going to get married anytime soon, but I wouldn't ever say that I wouldn't do it, you know.
Marriage does appeal to me personally. It's a family value. It means core and values and children and growing old with someone and being madly, deeply in love.
So when we asked young adults about marriage, we mostly heard the words outdated and unnecessary, except for that last hopeful view. And those who follow marriage trends wouldn't be surprised. People like local author Ethan Waters says young people are consciously prolonging the time between graduating from college and starting a family. In the meantime, they form networks of support that sustain them. Groups of friends, neighbors, acquaintances, co-workers, and classmates who form a kind of family. Waters calls them urban tribes, and he sat down with me to explain how they work.
There's ways in which the metaphor doesn't apply. This is not a multi-generational organization. Most tribes are multi-generational. You have elderly and people. This is a narrow strata of a sort of a narrower demographic. People are of similar ages. But indeed, within any vibrant urban tribe that I've documented, you do have people that rise to a leadership position. They're the people that have the house where you always can drop by. Oftentimes, they're sort of a queen bee character, a very vibrant woman. And I actually think it's because of the marriage delay in on the female side that you have the tribes that are so vibrant. In human history, there's always been a way for men to take time outside of a family in between boyhood and manhood. They go off and do something. Very rarely has there been that place for women. This is really unprecedented in human history for women to suddenly have this expansive time on their own outside of a family unit. So, and it's the addition of that energy, I think, to these tribes that makes them really vibrant places.
So let's talk then more about your story. You wrote this book in the end of your tribe years. How can you tell me the story of kind of how you decided to get married?
I was living with in a Victorian in the mission with five other roommates, and suddenly this woman came along who was not part of my tribe. She came from out of town, and suddenly she was there in my life, and I realized that I wanted to give this a try, and that did require that moment in time for that few year period. It required a stepping away from my role in the group, which was really one of the organizers of the group activities. It was my house was the place that people could come by. And I had to step away from that role. And I basically had to take a risk that I wasn't going to ask my friends' permission to do this, because I knew that the tribes often, that I didn't want to ask their permission for it.
How old were you?
So I was at the time 37. So I was, I'd lived 20 years basically outside of a family. This was an epic of my life, right?
You'd lived a good tribe life.
I'd lived it as long as and I think everyone, all those other sick roommates, they were all similar ages. We were in our 30s, middle 30s, all living together as roommates. When you look at it from my parents' perspective, it made them uncomfortable. They didn't know what it was. I think one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was to give it a name and to give it a story and to tell parents and the people that live through this time that this is a generational shift. This is not you just choosing not to get married for this expanse of time. Something has happened within our generation that has made us many people delay marriage for this amount of for this long period of time. And remarkably good things happen within that period of time. And the anxiety we have when we look in the bathroom mirror at 37 and we say, why aren't I married? Is something that you could take all on your shoulders, or you could take a step back and you could see it as a generational thing, which I think is much healthier. And so you could also see the positive things that happen within that period of time.
So she comes along,
yes,
from out of town.
Right. So Rebecca showed up in my life from out of town, and I did, a year into it. I think one of the things that happens also for people that delay marriage is things tend to happen very quickly when they do happen. So we were engaged a year after we met, and then we were married a year after that. And within that time, that was enough time to sort of let my roommates left the door open, and they wandered out, and eventually they didn't wander back in. But I didn't have to lay down the law or kick anyone out of the house.
How did they react? Did you get the resistance that you talk about?
A little bit. There was a little bit. So suddenly I wasn't available for some friends to do the things that we always did. And you get very comfortable in those years, time can go by very fluidly. And suddenly when you're not available to do the things that you always did, there is a little bit of sadness. I have to say, weddings for the tribe cohort can be remarkably cathartic experiences. Because it used to be about a family giving away, to another family. And now, although my parents were there, this was about my tribe sort of expressing solidarity in there. So there was, the tribe participated in every way. This was a very homegrown wedding. So it was my friends that were doing the music and doing the food. And it was a lovely expression of group support for this new endeavor,
You still live in the city, but... the latest census revealed that San Francisco has lost 5% of its kids. Do you ever feel the temptation to move to the East Bay, to the peninsula?
I think every parent that goes through the San Francisco public school lottery system and doesn't get the school they want thinks about the possibility of moving. having met a lot of those parents within the San Francisco school system, I think there's a remarkable wellspring of energy and desire to stay in the city. I think that statistic is going to swing. I think San Francisco is becoming a greater place to have children, to keep children. And the energy that parents, urban parents, have to do this is a lovely force in our generation, and it's going to continue that, and it's going to pave the way to have other people stay in the city with their kids.
So the urban tribe lives on beyond after marriage and children.
Absolutely.
You have your network now.
You have your network, and that can be employed to do all sorts of wonderful things in your life. Robert Putnam, in his book Bowling Alone, had it so wrong about this generation. We are not eschewing social capital. We are building it. And we're not as comfortable with this idea of social capital, you know, and that, even that metaphor, we're not that comfortable with this idea that you spend and you save social capital. We are more of a, we have more of a social bartering system where we give to the people around us and to our children, and we do it in a very lovely way. We don't sign up for the League of Women Voters, but we do a lot of other things that tie this city together. And if you lived in the city long enough, you can feel it around you. You realize that it's there. It's very hard for a statistician to come in and document it, to see those connections. Very complicated, but you know it if you've lived it.
That was Ethan Waters, author of Urban Tribes. You can read an excerpt from his book at kalwnews.org. That's also where you can hear his top five things to tell your parents when you're still single at age 30, 35, or 40.
What kind of lives are these? We're like children. We're not men.
No, we're not. We're not men.
We come up with all these stupid little reasons to break up with these women.
I know. That's what I do.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Today's young people may rely on urban tribes for their sense of community, but if you lived in San Francisco in the first half of the 20th century, it's likely your tribe was hanging out in Central Market. For the past couple of weeks, we've been taking you back to when this busy stretch of Market Street was a hub of activity and entertainment. Now we take you all the way to the 1960s, when Piper's Jewelers first opened between 6th and 7th Streets. Today, the neighborhood is a tableau of transition. People in residential hotels getting their lives on track, new businesses starting up, and artists decorating vacant storefronts. But at Piper's Jewelers, time seems to stand still. Reporter R.J. Lozada has this story.
When you walk into Piper's Jewelers, you'll find clocks of all sizes and types. Huge faces that tick, tock, and chime. But oddly enough, not in synchronicity.
And over here we have a range of timepieces. Anything from a simple watch like a Seiko, up to luxury watches like Burberry, Tag Heuer, antique wristwatch, a Patek Philippe.
The walls are covered in surprisingly well-kept red and gold wallpaper, which has been there since Ralph Piper opened up the store in the 1960s.
We've known Piper for a few decades. We met Mr. Piper, and then the 89 earthquake came.
That's Al Troy. He's been managing the shop since Mr. Piper retired. In addition to Al, Al's mom, who I'll call Mrs. Troy, resides in a nook at the rear of the store, looking over paperwork and sipping tea. Mr. Troy sits behind a small watch repair station near the cash register.
My father has had over 40 years of experience in doing the repairing of timepieces. He started when he was only 12 years old, and he followed a master, and he just worked his way up. If you throw in any timepiece at him, he can repair it.
With a collection that dates back to the 1920s, looking at watches and Pipers is like looking at a set of curated timepieces in fashion history.
You can kind of see the transition between like the people's taste and style. Yeah, from since the 20s all the way up to modern time. You notice some of the watches from the earlier days were smaller. Actually, throughout history, our watches have gotten bigger and bigger. Yeah, some of the ladies' pieces back in the days were as small as this here. It's almost like a pea-sized watch here.
The store has jewelry, wedding bands and diamond rings, and antique coins.
This is an 1870S American Gold Eagle $10 coin. It was minted right here in San Francisco. The mintage was only 8,000.
How exactly did you come by this coin? I mean, it's not, you don't pick that up off the street.
Indeed, yes. This was one of Mr. Piper's coin, and he gifted it to me during my high school graduation. So it's been staying in the shop ever since. Anybody who wants to look at it, he can come in and look.
But you can't buy it.
But you can't buy it.
A store where you can't buy items that are on display? It's a funny quirk of Piper's. But as Al says,
the value of an item is on the eye of the beholder.
To Al, some items are just too valuable to sell. But this archiving of items, be they coins from the 19th century or watch parts, makes the store invaluable.
We carry an extensive stock of parts that are no longer made, no longer built, because we've been in the business for so long.
In fact, Mr. Choi was brought in to repair the clock of the bell tower of Old St. Mary's Cathedral.
The clock is over 150 years old. The axle was broken and some of the bushings were broken as well. And since there were no parts for these clocks, so everything had to be done by hand, repaired by hand, the axles redone.
But to Mr. Choi, it was just another day of work, twiddling with the small gears at his repair station or refurbishing the clock in one of San Francisco's designated landmarks.
It's easy for him because he's been doing it for over 50 years, handmade. And that's one of the magic of mechanical timepieces, too, because you can always restore them and they can last for centuries, as opposed to newer timepieces where when something breaks, you just have to throw it away.
What year was this again?
1850s.
And then the repair, what year was that?
God, I don't even remember what year it was. See, and when you're in a shop, months can pass away and it feels like weeks and days. And it's a long time ago, but it just feels like yesterday.
It was a different yesterday too, as Al describes.
We've been in here for so long, and we've seen the different transformation of Market Street from a classy, high-end place where people used to wear hats and women wore dresses, into a place where it's so casual now. Back in the days, Mr. Piper's was also very active and very passionate about this area, keeping it clean. He was very involved with the city, with the police commission, Mid-Market Association, and definitely would like to see this place getting cleaned up again so that it would look like a world-class area again.
Or would that just be traveling back in time?
To check out the various items you can buy or just look at, stop by Piper's Jewelers at 1066 Market Street. Sights and Sounds of Central Market was produced by the San Francisco Arts Commission and is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. RJ Lozada reported this story with sound design by Stephanie Fu. Robin Takayama was the executive producer. To learn more about the Artery Project and the Sights and Sounds of Central Market, you can go to sfartscommission.com. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time to visit the most creative corners of the Bay Area soundscape. This is the Audio Files.
You hear that?
Can you hear me?
It's incredible.
A while back, we took you deep into outer space.
You're always going to have a whoosh sound when you go through something in a planetarium, so I was thinking, well, what if those whooshes were actually made of the signatures of the real planets that you're going through?
That's sound designer Christopher Hedge. KALW's Martina Castro spoke with him about how he did the sound design for the state-of-the-art Morrison Planetarium at the California Academy of Sciences. The show was called Life, a Cosmic Story.
Welcome to Earth.
But beyond imagining what Saturn sounds like, Hedge is also an accomplished composer. He's been composing for over 25 years with artists like Neil Young and Paul Horn. In the second part of his interview with KALW's Martina Castro, Hedge explains how his approach to recording music takes him all over the globe.
I think that's a good way of putting it. It takes me there because I'm not really driving in a way. It's those things that I am going to record and then interpret, because to me, sound is like a photograph. The moment that happens stays with that sound in this unique sort of way.
How are you?
Fine.
Okay. We all look bright, eh?
Yes.
Can we have a common song?
A lot of people, they think of recording as recording a group that's all playing at the same time. But a lot of us kind of grew up building things piece by piece. which means that the sound then becomes not only the instrument that you're playing, not only the notes that you're playing on it, but the moment that you're playing it. So that the thing that's in your mind sometimes is what's recorded. The emotion is what you're recording as much as the sound of the instrument and the notes that you're choosing. Becomes a different thing.
How so? I'm curious, how is it different?
All right. Think of a little bluesy guitar line, you know, perfectly recorded with a nice set of Neumanns and a soundproof room. And then take that same guitar line and put it in 1932, put it in a hotel lobby, and put it in the hands of somebody that's not making a nickel to play that music. It's the same notes. And it could even be the same exact guitar, but it is an entirely different thing. And it's affected by the room that it's in, and it's affected by the situation that it's in. That the moment of recording is the thing that's, it's what's happening. It can't be taken apart into notes and a perfection of playing and things like that. It has to be kind of an emotional thing, or it's not kind of worth recording.
As you say, you know, they take a photograph. Which one for you just takes you straight back?
There's a million of them. One that came up very recently was in this tiny little postage stamp of a rainforest that's left in Paraguay. The whole country looks like Kansas. And inside this little reserve is a girls' school. And the girls are a combination of the farmers who, you know, a lot of them poach the rainforest for trees, and the Aché Indians that live in the rainforest. Well, there's only a tiny number of elders that are left. Not even their children know how to sing the songs that they sang in the forest. And I wanted to make a point to these girls that unless they learn those songs now from these six or seven remaining elders, that they would never learn them because you're their children. And so in trying to make this point, I recorded this these three or four elders, and this woman sat down to sing this song and just burst into tears and was crying. And I thought I was scaring her to death with my boom microphone and my binaurals and all this equipment that is on me. And it turned out that the crying was the song. The next day, we invited her over to the girls' school, and she performed this for the girls. And of course, they're just in tears. They're completely destroyed because they had no idea, A, that these elders even sang or that did music at all, and B, it was apparent that it was disappearing, that they would lose this thing.
And so do you think you listen differently when you're traveling or when you're out in the world?
Yes, specifically. And there's a great little invention of microphones, one called a binaural mic. They used to put them in these like plastic heads that had modeled ears so that the two microphones would be at the natural distance between the ears. And I found a set that you can actually take off of the little dummy head and wear in your own ears, almost like a stethoscope. And those recordings are so three-dimensional that it brings a certain reality to the sound that's unique. And so with a little Zoom recorder or something in my pocket and a pair of these binaural microphones on, you can walk around and literally be the microphone. Many of my favorite adventures out in the world have been with Paul, and one of them was in a Tibetan nunnery outside of Kathmandu, and the nuns there had invited us to record, And they allowed us to sit there all day and record their chanting. And then they gave us their main monastery room for the night. And here's all this tangas on the wall and this big golden Buddha at the end of the hall. And Paul was starting to warm up. And I went over and I stood in front of him and I gave him that look. And he knows I'm recording. And he's playing, but he's playing to me like I'm recording with you. So he's just looking at me and just playing like this. And the sound is reverberating off of this place. And it's nighttime in the uplands of the Kathmandu Valley. And these things inhabit that sound. It becomes something. They become something that you can't do in the studio with a pan pot. It was really exciting.
That's composer Christopher Hedge speaking to KALW's Martina Castro. Some of the music you just heard was composed by Hedge for the award-winning PBS series The New Heroes. You can find more information at kalwnews.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Rose Arrieta, John Atkinson, Casey Miner, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.